Great. Thanks, Michael, and thank you all for coming, and it's a real pleasure to be invited to speak. So what I'm going to do is just share some of the learning that we've been looking into from eco-renovation projects, both in Oxfordshire, from the ones that we've personally been involved with, and also wider across the UK. So what I'm going to look at in these 20 minutes is looking at the scale of the eco-renovation challenges, the barriers and opportunities to eco-renovation, the open days, what they consisted of, what people do, how they transmit the information about eco-renovation, and then looking at what people have learnt, how has it changed, what they might have seen, how has it changed their behaviour, and drawing out some of the conclusions from that and looking at how that could supplement some of the current policy and initiatives that are taking place, what we could learn from the experiences, how they could contribute to wider eco-renovation, what else is needed, and specifically looking at some community-led energy saving schemes and opportunities for further engagement and research, all in 20 minutes. So just to clarify a couple of the concepts, in this sense, I'm using eco-renovation. I could have used eco-refurbishment or eco-retrofit. It's essentially renovation and refurbishment of existing properties to increase energy efficiency and decrease energy use and carbon dioxide emissions. And it's quite a broad scope. Some homes that have been involved in the open days have done everything. They've had solid wall insulation, they've had ground source heat pumps, they've had solar thermal, solar photovoltaic, and anything you can think of, as well as lots of different energy efficient appliances. Some have just done what they could do. So they might have completely installed light-emitting diodes plus maybe a solar photovoltaic system and also changed their behaviour. So it's a real range of renovations that have been involved in the open days. And social learning, I'm talking about in its broader sense, creating informal learning environments. And picking up Tim Jackson's comment that we learn most effectively from models who are attractive to us or influential for us, such as people who are successful or powerful, or people who are simply like we are. And it's that bit that I'm going to be really focusing in on in terms of the eco-renovation open days. So the scale of the challenge. Housing accounts for about 27% of the UK carbon emissions, 80% carbon dioxide reduction is needed by 2050. And by 2050, 80% of the homes we'll inhabit are already standing. So they're the ones that really should be a priority and focus of our attention at the moment. We need to deal with climate change mitigation for existing homes, but also adaptation, as was highlighted earlier. And that meeting these targets, meeting sort of retrofitting the existing homes at the moment, will probably require about 500,000 refurbishments per year. And that's drawing on research done by Gavin Killip for Federation of Master Builders and Building a Greener Britain report. So substantially more than is already happening at the moment. Before I go on and talk about the open days, I just want to outline some of the barriers and some of the opportunities. Again, I think we're all familiar with the negative perception of energy reduction that's associated with a reduced quality of life and also a disruption and hassle factor involved with installing energy-efficient technologies or retrofitting homes. The financial disincentive, high upfront costs potentially, and a long payback period. The skills capacity and availability of tailored information is also a barrier. There's lots of different housing types. People are in different situations with different budgets, and sometimes they don't know where to get help. The help and advice is there, but sometimes the pathways to that aren't necessarily clear, and sometimes it's not as much of an invitation. It's also about engagement of public, and I think that was also highlighted earlier. There's a public know that something needs to be done, and they don't see that leadership evident necessarily from the government as well. So there is confusion and dissonance in what's been said, what they need to do, and what they see other people doing. It's also technology. Sometimes eco-renovation and some of the micro-generation is quite focused in on technological approaches and just sort of trying to navigate your way through this if you're not technologically minded and thinking, now what's the difference between solar thermal for me and solar photovoltaic? And a lot of people who have installed these systems have had to do a lot of research on their own, which really brings out Brenda Waldman's comments of the rate of improvement in the energy efficiency of the general housing stock is largely dependent on the initiatives of the owners at the moment. It's certainly true for a lot of the eco-renovators that we've been in contact with. They've had to put a lot of time and effort into finding out which situation is best for them. That's obviously time and effort that not everyone has. There's also a complex and fragmented energy efficiency market, dominated by a small number of very large players, and the delivery is mainly through a very large number of small and medium enterprises. And so the opportunity for learning between the supply sector is also a real opportunity that we need to take up. The opportunities for eco-renovation are the current housing slump. People might be in their properties longer and might be thinking, how can I increase the marketable value of this property? Fuel price increases, and the potential new market for jobs in eco-renovation and refurbishment could be worth between £3.5 and £6.5 billion per year. And this is again drawing on the Building a Greener Britain report. And I think those will essentially be new jobs. It'll be the construction industry thinking, okay, I'm a plumber and I can also increase my skills portfolio by learning about solar installation as well and solar hot water. There's also trigger points for opportunities such as moving house, doing it alongside existing renovation or refurbishment or any improvements, and a room by room approach. It's a real opportunity for going with the aspirational kitchen and bathroom replacement. So the open days, the open house events. Through many different approaches, and in 2007 and 2008, there was at least 10 area-wide eco-renovation open days in Oxfordshire, which is the one I've been involved in organising, Brighton, Stroud, Enid Lloyd, Norwich, London Open House, nationally through the Sustainable Energy Academy's Old Home Superhome project, and also increasingly through the Heritage Open Days, so piggybacking on existing areas of outreach and engagement. So some of the events in those places have been covering about 120 very different homes, attracting over 36,000 visitors nationally, and there's additional events planning this year. All events are kind of organised differently, but they have many things in common. They're often organised by a local group or local organisation, feature mostly eco-renovation, but some new build homes, but are also a variety of homes. So you can see here just two of the ones in Oxfordshire, well, three in Oxfordshire. We have a 1970s flat, a 17th century cottage in a conservation area, which has reduced its emissions by up to 80%, and a 1930s home as well, which has reduced its emissions by about 50 to 60%. In most cases, the homes are open from about 2 hours to 2 days, and they're homes that people live in. There's a few of them which have been showcase homes, and some of them in London have been local authority eco-renovated homes that's been open for a number of weekends in a row as a showcase before being let as a home. So what do people learn? Take note that 100% is 100% of responses to the question, not 100% of all visitors here. But we can see that there's a lot of opportunities for learning about different areas of draft proofing, insulation, heating systems, recycled materials. That there's learning is generally high. One thing that was surprising is that whilst a lot of the open days are marketed about see a whole range of solar thermal and different innovative materials in use, we didn't actually sell it on their come and see insulation and come and see energy efficiency, but from people's responses, people learn a lot more about insulation and energy efficiency, and I think potentially because that was embedded within larger incorporation of microgeneration. And one comment was, I had not appreciated that my insulation measures could be improved significantly. Moving on to more general feedback, again, you can see that people are very pleased they came. They think touch and feel visits, so actually experiencing what an eco-renovated home could be like, is a good way of learning about solutions, and it has inspired people to do more in their house and improve their understanding. The two other aspects are people aren't so clear on how they might tackle improvements to their own home and don't have such a large appreciation of the cost involved. And this does correspond with recent research showing how information gaps in the cost of installation, who installs the technology, and how it's installed, and more crucially, who they can trust to install it. And so when people were going around houses, they were very interested in any positive recommendations of installers or specific technologies as well. So some more qualitative feedback does show a range of responses, from the inspiration, wonderful idea, inspiring and valuable to get feedback from people who have done it, inspiring but somewhat daunting. And it shows the opportunity as well, which is one of the things we're trying to get people to be aware of, the opportunity, so that there are things that can be done even without money, using an emergency perhaps to make improvements. And then showing the next steps, so people are interested talking to the building contractor, and with the open days we did try and have some of the people in the supply side as well along to give some expert advice at the same time. And also trying to demystify some of the technologies, seeing touching lime plaster has really clarified how people are going to approach it in their own homes. There's more feedback done in Norfolk and Brighton. So Brighton received pledges from visitors saying what actions they were going to take. And in Norfolk, 95% of the attendees said that they increased their understanding of energy efficient technologies, and some of them had already taken practical steps as a result of visiting the previous year. So what's the potential? I'm not going to go through everything here. I think essentially it's about increasing the visibility of existing renovation strategies and what could be specifically applicable to different people's homes. It also shows what's technically possible, beyond what could be just cost-effective and some of the advice that is just given by great agencies, so the Local Energy Savings Trust, but sometimes that can be limited to what is cost-effective. It really does show the potential for where people can go beyond that and really reduce their emissions significantly more. It also demonstrates the benefits and increases the visibility and shows the pathways to moving up a band in your energy performance certificates. And I think it really highlights that with the sort of Great British Refurb Plan, whole house upgrades will have to do a significant amount of learning from what's already happened, what's already taken place, and how to increase that learning from people, both on the supply and the demand side. And you'll see I'm sort of thinking, how can we learn from the open days in terms of DEFRA's 4E's model, so we can help enable the visitors by removing barriers, giving information, demonstrating the pathways, and sharing experiences. We can engage people. People engage through trusted messengers, through maybe their neighbours. There's positive, visible perception of energy reduction, hands-on experiences, focusing on local homes, and using local networks and local media in informal settings. Exemplify is really important here. Homes are exemplified, but also the people who've done it are exemplified as well, demonstrating local people leading by example. And I think really stepping out of the householder as consumers, it's also householder as citizens, saying, this is what we could do. I'm going to use my experience to share with other people, to say what is possible and encourage people to take place. And I think a lot of the people who've taken part have really increased their confidence to share their ideas, share what they've done. People saying it's tough, but also exhilarating, like a good party should be. And then somebody else saying, delighted that people came and were interested in my houses. It also encourages visitors and how it harnesses the full social capital of achieving eco-renovation. But what else is needed? I'd say follow-up. There's a lot of inspiration. How do we turn that into action? And specific tailored advice and information is needed to enable the next steps. Identifying the trigger points and really acting on them. How do we publicise it to estate agents? More technology demonstrations. And again, upskilling the construction sector and the supply side. I'll just briefly say that there are a lot of fantastic examples of community-led energy saving schemes. And two of these household energy services uses volunteers in the community to do that real one-to-one tailored advice. It's a community approach, and Bishop's Castle 310 surveys have showed lifetime savings of 2,550 tonnes of carbon dioxide. And then Low Carbon West Oxford, another project local to me, uses volunteers to give expert tailored advice and financing that through local microgeneration on warehouse buildings. So it's a great way of getting the local businesses to say, yeah, we can have some roof space taken up with solar photovoltaics, and that will help pay for some of the renovations that are needed. There's also approaches such as eco teams, so monthly meetings of people, reductions of about 16% of carbon dioxide has been shown, and Cambridge Carbon Footprint holds workshops and delivers an average of about 1 ton of carbon dioxide. One of the crucial things of this is, yes, it does appeal to the people who are already engaged at the beginning, but because it's led by the communities, certainly Household Energy Services, who've been going for a couple of years in the community, are seeing significant inclusion of other sectors, people who wouldn't necessarily have been involved at the beginning because they've been told about it through their friends or people down the pub or people next door. So I think that's really important to bring out some of the community benefits of those schemes. But there are opportunities for further engagement. Open house events are very time-consuming, basically. There's a real opportunity to link up more of the case studies online and video walkthroughs. It's a real opportunity to engage other sectors, so social housing, doing social housing demonstrations, and also estate agents, targeted at people who've got the opportunity to change. And again, a big opportunity for that construction upskilling. So parity projects in London are enabling the construction industry to basically lead beyond their authority, suggest opportune times for eco-renovations alongside routine repairs and maintenance. So potential for further research, looking at actions and behaviour changes resulting from visiting the open homes, longitudinal studies of visitors, assessing all events on a common basis, and widening the approach across other supply chains and sectors, and looking at the impact of the current energy prices and recession. So before I finish, I just want to leave you with a poem from one of our eco-renovators. It's called December. Yesterday was bright, panels on my roof, focused light, captured heat. It waited, insulated. Tonight, a lovely soak, hot and deep, sunbathing. That's from our eco-renovating granny in Oxford. So just thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Jo. That's fascinating. And hold your thoughts and questions, which I'm sure you have some. We'll move on to Thomas, who's from the University of Durham. Do you just want to say a little bit about what you're doing at the moment there before, while I just find your presentation?
My presentation isn't going to be exactly the way you summarised it, but right. We'll get into that. I hope, as notice that swine flu has already come up, and I hope no one will consider it in poor taste if I make that my starting point. Has anybody here actually had swine flu? And did everybody get this leaflet through the door? I even got to my village out in County Durham. So, did you all read it like good citizens? Yeah, I completely ignored it. It was straight on its way to the recycling until somebody directed my attention to page 7, where in the midst of what's frankly a disempowering document, it appears that some community development activist has seen an opportunity to nurture social capital through mutual aid. It says, under what else can I do? It says, set up a network of flu friends, neighbours, friends and relatives who could help you if you get ill. Has anybody involved in a flu friends network? We don't have many swine flu activists out here. And I have to admit again that I'm of a similar mindset. I'm about as swine flu conscious as this boy here. But reflecting on my attitude to swine flu, I realised it was very, very instructive in terms of putting me in the mindset of those people that Michael mentioned as the hard to reach and the non-committed. Those people who, if they think about climate change at all, don't consider it an issue upon which they're motivated to act. And I think that if I've rapidly changed my attitude to swine flu, if I caught it, if anybody I care about caught it. But as Anthony Giddens pointed out this morning, by the time reality catches up with the apathetic and the sceptical about climate change, it will already be too late. My take on how to engage with and motivate this probably still the majority of people, and to get out of the simply preaching to the converted and involving the usual subjects, is informed by my previous experience working in participatory and community-led approaches to biodiversity conservation, which, although a very different problem in most of its details, shares the common feature that it's a globally recognised issue supported by a largely scientifically informed discourse whose general solution will require a multitude of local actions and engagement with very diverse stakeholders, most of whose points of view and whose perspective on the problem differs greatly from that of the dominant discourse informed by conservation biology. The central point I'm going to argue today is that the lesson we can learn is in the extent to which this practice has gone from problematizing diversity and the extent which the questions used to be, how on earth do we persuade these people to behave in the right way, to nurturing and working with diversity, which it's now become apparent is the key resource for practical action. A key concept in this that I'll just briefly introduce is one of biocultural diversity, which in basic terms are the observed correlations between the geographical distributions of biological and cultural diversity. The causes of these correlations are only poorly understood, but it appears that one important factor is the extent to which culturally specific, localized perspectives and views on nature encapsulate bodies of knowledge and practice in resource management that are specific to the details of the local ecological context. So there are specific knowledges of the local biota that on a global scale, conservation biologists are concerned with protecting. And so, if we examine how this dominant, global, scientifically informed discourse has engaged with these diverse local viewpoints and perspectives, the local knowledge systems of traditional resource users, of people who have long-term historical economic relationships with the local biotas, we can identify four main stages. The first here I've labelled ignorance, the idea that only those who were part of this master narrative derived from science could contribute useful information. So everybody else had to be told what to do, which was what education meant back in those days, or forced to behave in the appropriate way, which was engagement back in those days. From about the 1950s, anthropologists largely began to produce information as to the scientific accuracy and especially the practical effectiveness of much of this knowledge, which from about the 1980s began to be incorporated in development discourses that, although giving lip service to participation, wouldn't challenge the presumed authority and sole authority of the scientifically informed understanding. Greater political assertion on the part of traditional resource users later led to what tends to dominate at least the most enlightened approaches to biodiversity conservation today, these multi-stakeholder dialogues based on incorporating and reconciling multiple views. Today, certainly in theory and based upon theoretical positions like that of biocultural diversity, we recognise the necessity of these diverse perspectives and viewpoints as complementary outlooks on a problem that's too big and too complicated for any single idea, however powerful and compelling, to address. These changes have had both political and practical causes, as I've talked about, and in examining the practical basis, I'd like to use this representation of the environmental knowledge of traditional resource users, which I've taken from the work of Fikret Berkins on traditional ecological knowledge, in which he recognises four successively nested levels of analysis, so they should be more or less each level encompassing that's prior to it, so each embedded in a more fundamental level. So at the bottom we have the knowledge, following from that, the management practices. These are very fast change and immediately responsive to rapid environmental change. People will revise their knowledge in the light of new information. The social institutions and worldviews on nature in which knowledge and successively management are embedded are far more conservative and fundamental and resistant to change. What's important here is, as it says on the left there, that these worldviews and institutions embody substantial accumulated and collective knowledge, not just about the environment, but more crucially about social mechanisms to act upon new information. So the new information, new knowledge that's acquired, new practices that are adopted, are enacted through existing social mechanisms and worldviews. And it's at these more superficial levels that when scientific resource management engages with traditional resource users on their own terms, their knowledge engages. And in the examples where this has promoted rapid behavioural change in response to new environmental information that's beyond the scope of people's traditional systems of knowledge, people's traditional capacities for inquiring and processing information about the environment, this change has taken place rapidly and successfully, largely because it mobilises the social knowledge of promoting pro-social behaviour that exists within the social institutions and the worldviews. So the big difference when we're talking about engaging diverse actors, diverse communities in our own society about climate change is that our institutions and worldviews, their institutions and worldviews, don't embody environmental knowledge of this type, and this has a quite simple explanation in terms of the histories and the historical requirements. Where parts of societies and all the globally dominant societies have a history of expansionism, which has meant none of us have ever had to learn to live within our ecological means until now. When I talk about these sort of themes, people sometimes accuse me of being anti-science. I'm not anti-science at all, and particularly in this case, it's clear that the environmental knowledge which we lack and the type of environmental knowledge we need to understand and climate change, to know it's happening and to consider technical solutions to address it, can only come from a scientific discourse of global scope and reach. But if this discourse is also treated as the sole basis for a solution, it not only perpetuates and reproduces the social institutions and the worldviews that are among its causes, and in the recent Prosperity Without Growth report, we got some insights into the problematic nature of the existing political and economic institutions and the worldviews that underlie them. It also lacks some means to engage with the social knowledge that the groups with which it's attempting to engage have. So it's not mobilising the social capital that Michael talked about, the capacities for change and for promoting collective action. So, and these capacities are part of the local diversity which has been problematized in discourses on climate change. My basic argument is that this has been treated as part of the problem, but should be examined and treated as part of the solution. As I said, it doesn't only in exceptional circumstances does it include the type of technical and environmental knowledge that's necessary to address climate change, but it does include detailed knowledge of the local socio-cultural scenarios through which solutions have to be achieved and how to negotiate and use these. And the practical program I suggest for mobilising these capacities, so for working with these diverse local social knowledges rather than trying to confront them, is one that will be familiar in outline to anybody who's experienced in community development. So examine who these communities are, who these people are, what their common interests are, their major concerns, and only then look where the overlap between these concerns and local issues and the overriding agenda and concern with climate change that we're coming from, where these overlap, where their common ground is, and make this the basis of our action on the issue. So what I'm saying in short is that we should reconceptualize our notions and our actions regarding climate change as issues of social justice. And so to the extent that which, as all of us do to some extent, the extent to which we represent this dominant discourse, not seek to educate and engage communities, but instead seek to help them to educate and to engage us. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. That was excellent. And we now have about 10 or 15 minutes to ask questions and get the responses and have a discussion. So I'll open it up to the floor, and if you could say who your question is directed to, we'll do it one at a time, I think. So, yeah, down here.
Hi. I'm Prashant Ayal, I work for Consumer Focus. My question is really targeted at Joan. I was involved with the Camden government, Southern Alexis, for one of the volunteers there. I think over the course of the 10 or so days that it was open, I suspect probably about 2 or 3,000 people visited, which represents roughly 0.5% of the population of Camden. The real sort of dominant theme in terms of energy efficiency over the last few years has really been in government programs. So, Sturt and before that, its predecessor, policies like Youth and ESOL. I think the real challenge for us, given that the low rates of spontaneous take up for innovation, and you know, we spoke to many, many people who are very well aware of the challenges. The real challenge is really how do we address the kind of problem that we're given today about the necessity to act now, even though it's not in the interest of the majority of people now. And something is that you learned from your review of the various programs which addresses it. So if we're going to essentially move to a maintain this kind of top-down, and let's be honest, at the moment, Sturt is delivering 400,000 or 500,000 homes a year, and there's 8 million homes that are lacking capital wall insulation. Yeah. How do we get solid wall insulation? What do we learn from these capital insulations?
Great question. I think one of the things I've learned from it is about, instead of saying you must do this, creating it in a sort of aspiration. And I think increasingly getting people prepared to make an eco-renovation when they're doing an existing renovation. So as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people have said, yeah, I'm really interested, it's not the right time for me now. So they might be really, really wanting to do it, but haven't got the funding, the skills, the capacity to do it for whatever reason at the moment. So I think for me, I'm really looking at how we incorporate the supply chain into that, how we get people to be proactively suggesting for every renovation that there could be an eco-renovation. So if we're doing work, if we're doing plumbing, yes. Anything that the top-down programs can learn, I think, is demonstrating what could be technically possible. So people might do an eco-renovation maybe once in a lifetime, so making sure that people are doing the best possible one they can. And also knowing that cost is a huge barrier. So I think top-down, probably increasing the financing and making the financing easier and more longer-term and probably attached to the property.
which takes me very nicely on to what I'm trying to do. I'm actually a councillor at Camden. Mm-hmm. And I've been proposing for the last year a scheme whereby we borrow long term as a council and we lend to householders. In fact, they don't really get the money, we'll give it to a couple of companies that have been specially trained to do solid wall insulation and double glazing. So we get around this upfront problem of people not having the funding.
Yeah.
And then they can pay back a little bit per month, enough to cover our long term interest borrowing, and then pay off the principal when they sell the property. Mm. So that we give them an incentive to actually get involved. And then we can say, as with the cable companies, we're coming down your street next week. There's a tried and trusted company that we've trained. Get on board.
And I totally agree. I think the sort of street by street and area by area, just like let's just do it approaches, I think have got a lot to be said for them to help enable people to take that step.
However, the big problems are that officers in councils are very risk averse, and government is frankly not being very helpful in this, because they see the energy companies, partly because they see the energy companies as a way to do this, whereas actually energy companies, their primary purpose is to make profit and push as much energy as possible, not to do the energy efficiency stuff.
Okay, we have a question at the front and then one at the back, so take the one at the front first.
My name's Mike Bell from the Empowerment Institute. I'd like to add a couple of things to that conversation that's just started. One of them is we don't have a good understanding of what's needed for behaviour change. We think giving people information and educating them brings about behaviour change, and if it doesn't, there's enough evidence out there that says it doesn't. My organisation and actually Weight Watchers have some of the best research on what's needed. You've got to engage people at an emotional and cognitive level. You've got to give them structures for measuring, keeping count, and setting goals, and you've got to give them a support group. Now that is the best advice that's around, So that's one thing. And most of our policymakers don't understand it. Most of the senior people in our local authorities don't understand it. Where I come from, my local authority spent £400,000 on an eco-dome project in the belief that it was going to change behaviours. It doesn't. And I guess one of my questions to you, Joe, is, well, what are the behaviour change design principles embedded in the Eco Homes project that would lead you to believe there will be some behaviour change? Because if there aren't any there, why would you research that?
Yeah.
Can I just deploy just to add that, you know, what we had with the Camden Eco House was this fantastic Victorian retrofit, which reckons to reduce carbon emissions by the magic 80%, and we got 2,500 people going around it in a very short period of time. But where we failed was in taking that inspiration, pretty much exactly as Jo was saying in her presentation. We failed to then move them on to the concrete stuff of who can you get to do it, what can you, you know, when can you do it, and how can we help you financially to actually get it. So I reckon those 2,500 people, maybe a couple of people went off and put in a little bit of insulation, but most people were just, oh, right, that's what we need to do.
Okay.
And that's another part that's missing. There's a great book called The Diffusion of Innovation. You are always going to get the first 15% of early adopters. Mm. Forget about the late majority at the beginning. They're never going to come on board. In fact, they're going to spoil the picture for you.
We don't have a great amount of time, so maybe if Joe could respond to that. We then got two questions about, one from the gentleman there, and then one from Peter, and hopefully one of those might involve a question to Thomas. So if you could just reply to that, and then we'll take the two at the back.
A brief response. I totally agree that just sort of one-off visits might not necessarily be enough to increase behaviour change, but I think that's where the community-based follow-up and support is really crucial, and the support groups and the kind of either eco teams or different clubs, so that people can get support and share learning. So I think I'm not saying that open days are the thing in themselves. I'm saying that they can really highlight what is possible, so that people can seize the opportunity when they've got it, but also local-based support or national support, some tailored one-to-one advice or support is really crucial, so that people can really make the most of their visit.
Did you want to come back on that?
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that the point of engaging with people where they're at. You have a good deal of response on the basis of the eco-renovation, but are people also interested, those who didn't respond to the house as an eco-home, are they interested in sound insulation? Are they interested in reduced fuel bills? And if not, what is it about their domestic environment? What are their priorities that might motivate them to action? And to what extent are they consistent with the nature of the eco-home, which in most respects I imagine is a far nicer place to live?
Okay, question from the gentleman on the right, and then Peter.
Yeah. This is for Joe as well. I'm Chris Sherman Smith, University of Exeter. The water industry is one of the, let's say, hidden largest users of energy in the country. Unfortunately, I'm a bit disappointed there's no mention of the word water or its integration into any of the eco homes in your presentation, which is a shame. And I would hope that, for example, under your opportunities for future engagements, there will be greater link-ups both with the water industry and with local authorities and with individuals that are looking to reduce their water usage.
Yeah, for sure. And I was good point, but I was mainly concentrating today on energy, but a lot of the homes did have significant water saving features in them, and there was a lot of learning about them. So apologies for not including that in the wider discussion
really
today.
It's important that they are mentioned at the same time these days. And especially crossovers like hot water issues.
Okay, we have a question right at the back from Peter.
This is Thomas. Thank you for the presentation. I was wondering about your comment that people, much of the climate change discourse is embedded in the worldview that generated the problem to begin with, how we might exit that.
how we might
exit being trapped in the worldview that generated crowd. I thought that the talk by Lord Gibbons this morning was a good example of sort of being a prisoner of the worldview, right? That is in fact generated the problem, not being able to step outside that space.
I'd agree, and that's the more radical take on the talk that I gave. But we need to examine the extent to which addressing climate change obliges us to consider political reform. We need to work with the existing political and economic structures, because even if they are going to change, we don't have time. And account like Oliver Tickle's Kyoto 2 gives a very, what to my eye seems as reasonable as account as you might expect from a worldview that's embedded in free market economics as its most salient feature. The best attempt that could make to provide a global solution to the problem, it ignores the diverse local contexts that I've been talking about through which that large-scale solution would have to actually be implemented on the ground. And I think in devising and working towards developing our own institutions that can work, that can engage creatively and ideally non-confrontationally to the extent that we can with those, is an important way forward.
Right, we've got time probably for two more questions. I'll take them in the order that the hands went up. So first of all, lady at the back, and then lady at the front.
My name's Diane, I'm just a small comment. I'd just be interested, you mentioned the fact that not all technical knowledge created is the most practical maybe when it was in line with the existing worldview. And I was just interested if you had any examples of where that happened.
Yeah. There are several in conservation biology. The one I usually give to my students, I can direct you to the original publications. It's a study by Becker of a community forest scheme in Ecuador, where people were economically dependent on the forest to an extent, but they didn't appreciate the role of the forest in watershed conservation. So a group of conservation biologists who were concerned with the biodiversity values of the forest, which the local people had no interest at all, came and educated people about the watershed preservation role of the forest. And once people were aware of this, they realised that if they continued unsustainable timber harvesting practices that they had at the time, they'd lose their water supply. They very rapidly mobilised forest conservation and sustainable harvesting measures, and there are an increasing number of examples in the literature which I can direct you to.
Thank you.
My name is Pam Lam. I direct something called the Good Lives Project, which is a Quaker funded project looking at behavioural change. This is a comment really rather than a question, which is about, so broadly, yes, it's right that in the consumerist West, we don't have those local vernacular knowledge as you're talking about. But I was really thinking about looking for the places where we do. Mm-hmm. One interesting one is that we have a rapid diminishing population that we're in the process of losing at the moment, who lived through World War II and Russia, who know a great deal about this. And we have practices in primary schools of doing oral history with older people in your family and your community. And it seems there is a wonderful opportunity for children to go around the technical course and talk to those who are left of the generation who lived through World War II, both in urban and in rural contexts where the knowledge bases are quite different. And I was struck by this because of a recent Transition Towns conference where they were having a workshop teaching people how to darn socks. And I thought, how extraordinary, don't even know how to darn socks. Well, if you're substantially younger than that and you've grown up where what you do with socks with holes in is broken away and buy new ones, then no, you don't know how to darn socks. And darning socks is kind of a very funny illustration, but actually it's right on the nail of where the problem is. And how do you find people who know how to dance? Well, you ask older people, because we know. And older than me know other things. And there is, I just think, this is somebody in the education system to get every primary school in the country working on this. There could be a wonderful database of knowledge and of children talking to older people and valuing what those older people have to offer. And it's a form of historical rather than geographical vernacular knowledge in terms of your speaking.
Thank you.
Interesting. What he thinks of the transition movement as part of his answer to that question.
Yeah, maybe. Do you want to come back, Joe, on that, or Thomas first, maybe, and then Joe, yeah, as a wrap up, and taking in that point there.
I'd agree fully with your comment. My talk, reasons of brevity, over-essentialised and homogenised, and it's entirely true that there are existing skills which are, in most cases, dying out because they're no longer considered useful, and which are the types of part of the existing social capital upon which we can build. A lot of the institutional capacity I talked about is viewed as the outcome of social learning processes that resulted from past crises. I'm currently based in the Northeast, and I wonder, thinking from a bit of a transition sort of perspective, the extent to which the coping mechanisms that must have arisen within the mining areas around Durham after the mining strike, when the industry closed, how did people cope with the economic collapse? What did what social mechanisms arose, and is there a social memory of existing institutions upon which we can build to work towards a decarbonised society? The transition discourse, has a great emphasis on reskilling, especially in agricultural skills, and people learning from mostly older people who tend to retain the knowledge of how to produce our own food. I have a lot of time for the transition movement, and I'm actually involved in my local group in Durham. And I think in principle, the basic principles derived from permaculture upon which transition is based are essentially about this nurturing and working with existing diversity that but my talk was about from a very different perspective. It's about examining and mobilising existing capacities. In practice, I think it's a long way from achieving that, because I was at the same transition conference about a month ago, and my impression there was that a lot of people were still stuck in this mindset of one of the things I agreed with from Anthony Giddens' talk was the need to not to be stuck in a green ghetto and not to have dividing lines and us and them, especially with climate change. We're all in it together, and the green movement doesn't have any right to presume authority or place of to be the leader. It's part of nurturing the capacities we have and all being together. I think I got the impression that the transition movement is thinking about that, and but it'll only be if it does really have long-term practical effects, which is yet to demonstrate. It'll only be one of many different ideas which will play a part.
Thanks. And a few final comments from Joe, and then we'll just about have time for a coffee before the next one.
Just with regard to sort of the transition movement, but also the kind of growing networks of lower carbon communities. So another UK-wide network is a low carbon communities network as well as the Energy Savings Trust Community Action for Energy networks. I think they're great in increasing the visibility of what's already going on and sharing a positive vision and sharing practical examples of how to achieve that at a local level and increasing citizenship and encouraging people to lead where there is a lot of, at a local level, people, there is a perception of a leadership vacuum. So seeing your peers leading, I think, is tremendously empowering. It's not enough on its own, but I think at the moment it's providing a really important demonstration that people can take the lead and they don't have to wait for somebody to ask them to take the lead. They can just get on and do it. And I think that citizenship thing at a local level is really important.
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming to this session. I think we've covered quite a lot of ground. Who'd have thought it, from swine flu to darning socks? And there's obviously the challenges for mobilising community action is considerable, but not insurmountable. So maybe you could just join me thanking Joe and Thomas.